thank you for your attention. Feel free to continue to eat and pass the food if necessary. As I mentioned, I'm Dan Gibbons from the City Club of Chicago, and it is my great honor today to welcome our guest of honor, who we're going to hear from in a conversation format. He's the congressman for Illinois' 8th congressional district since 2017, and as you may have heard, he's running for another office. And he's a great public servant who's been here at City Club a number of times over the years. As City Club, he understands civic engagement. He had a business before he was in government. He's a lawyer. He gets what we do here and why we talk about all the great things that we're discussing. And he's done a lot to move our state forward. And of course the suburban district, but of the city as well. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. If you will, please join me in welcoming Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. And as I mentioned, Congressman, I know you've been to City Club a couple of times. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I wasn't here, or at least we didn't have this kind of a chat last time. So the number one question that's been burning for me is, what do I call you?
Call me Raja.
Oh, okay. I hadn't heard that before.
Just call me Raja.
Well, Raja, no, you are a congressman. You've earned that title. I'll probably slide that in a few times
okay. Here.
Thank you for being here. You're obviously incredibly busy. And I want to get into some of the things that you're busy doing and talking about, and more importantly, hearing. You know, as you're touring the state, we have a couple of pre-submitted questions, but as you all hear what the congressman has to say, I'd like for you to think of a couple questions to ask him, and I'll leave some time for that at the end. But let's start with now that I know what to call you. Let's start with what's on your mind. You tackle so many different issues, right? From global to local. What's number one right now for you?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. This is my third time, and what a great crowd. Thank you for taking time out of your schedules to be here. What's on my mind? I'm worried about the future of our country. I'm worried about whether the possibilities and opportunities that were conferred on my family are available to other people. And maybe I can just tell you a little bit about my backstory so you can understand why I'm so concerned. Basically, I was born in India, and I came to this country when I was 3 months old to Buffalo, New York. And that's where my father studied engineering. And things were going great until suddenly the recession of 1973 hit us extremely hard. My father lost his income, but thanks to the generosity of the American people, we were allowed to move into public housing and food stamps. So I spent about half of my early childhood in those two life-sustaining programs. And then my father got on his feet and then got a great job in, of all places, Peoria, Illinois. And they loaded up the U-Haul truck and drove and drove and drove until they reached Peoria. And that's really where we entered the middle class. And pretty much every night my father would say something along the lines of, think of the greatness of this country. Think of the greatness of this country, and whatever you do, make sure it's there for the next families who need it. So that became the North Star of my personal compass. And so fast forward through college and law school, I ended up back in Illinois. I served as deputy treasurer and then helped to start the anti-corruption unit of the Illinois Attorney General's office. Business was good. I went into the private sector. I ran a very small company, and then I got elected to this position. And five terms later, that mission statement assigned to me by my parents has become the mission statement of my office. And indeed, that's my why. That is my why. It is basically, how do I make sure that American dream that we were privileged to attain is available to everyone, regardless of whether they're working poor, middle class, or growing a business? And I feel like right now in the economic chaos of Donald Trump, that American dream seems to be slipping out of grasp for millions of people, if not becoming impossible for millions more. So that is the number one thing that I'm concerned about right now. And we can talk more about it, but that has different cascading political effects, other economic effects, and if we don't fix that, we're going to be in big trouble.
So we can get into that. Well, let's stick with it. I mean, you mentioned President Trump, and you're a ranking congressman now. You're hearing briefings that we're probably not privy to.
I can only tell you by signal, if that's okay.
A lot of blanks.
Just kidding.
What's going on in Washington that you're hearing that maybe it's not making its way back here? What's really happening? There's a lot of fear. You talk about immigration. We're hearing funding cuts. We're hearing sanctuary cities that aren't going to get funded for all sorts of things. But now I think we're more than hearing that, we're seeing it locally. What's really happening, and is that going to continue? Is that going to get worse?
Look, I think this is my theory, which is that I think that Donald Trump is mismanaging the economy, and that I'm sure a lot of you are probably talking to people as well, but I'm talking to people who are getting laid off at this point. People solidly in the middle class who are getting laid off or are about to or fear that they're going to get laid off. I'm talking to small businesses who, because of the tariff chaos, are facing tremendous business uncertainty. We were on a listening tour. Part of it is called the tariff tour. So we've been visiting businesses throughout Illinois who've been affected, from small businesses in Rockford, manufacturing firms, farmers in central Illinois. I'll just tell you about one 25-person business in Rockford. That business was going gangbusters as of March 31st. It was expanding like crazy. And then Liberation Day hit. They had to hit the brakes, and now they're laying people off. I believe that is perhaps the most underreported story of this economy, that this is happening beneath the surface at numerous places throughout Illinois and across the country. Donald Trump knows this because he sees it in his poll ratings. Coming into office, his net approval on managing the economy was positive. Now, 60% of Americans disapprove of his handling of the economy. I was in Mount Vernon last week, Mount Vernon, Illinois, and a woman told me the price of groceries has gone up since he got elected. She's not a very political person. She said the price of groceries has gone up, gas has gone up by 50 cents since he got elected. So what part of this economy did he improve? He's hearing it from, I'm sure that they are monitoring this, and so because of that, they're big trouble politically. They're going to lose the House and in Congress. They might even, I don't know, they might have trouble in the Senate. So he's now finding ways to distract attention from that. I also think the Epstein file thing, which we can talk about, which is really bizarre, what's happened there is also a huge problem for him within the Republican conference. So with the Epstein file issue and the mismanagement of the economy, he wants to change the channel. And the way he changes the channel is by various distractions. And so I think that's what's really going on. When he does a sudden crackdown on ICE, with ICE, it's a distraction. When he goes after trans people, it's a distraction. When he orders Greg Abbott to redistrict the hell out of the Texas map to wipe out Democrats from the federal delegation, it's a distraction, and it would help him to salvage the majority. But I think it's fundamentally distracting attention from the underlying issue. So that's what I feel is really going on. And so substantively, I also feel if they don't address those underlying issues, they're not going to be able to get rid of them. And those will come back to haunt them in the next election.
So what is the underlying issue? If those are all distractions, if immigration reform or immigration is not really the driver, if What's his goal? What's the underlying issue?
Well, I think that his underlying issue is he wants to solidify power in Washington, D.C. He wants to absolutely keep the House and the Senate in 2026. He's even hinted at a third term. Now, you may be wondering, what the hell is that about? It turns out there's on the MAGA right, they have a theory about the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution that it only prohibits a president from being elected twice, not that a president could not serve more than two terms. You might ask, how would they accomplish that? Well, one theory that is now actively circulating in MAGA circles is J.D. Vance could be nominated for president and Donald Trump could be nominated for vice president. And that would somehow then allow him to be on the ticket again, and he could then be elected, and then J.D. Vance would step aside. This is the kind of craziness that we're hearing on the other side. It's kind of a grab for power now, but solidify it for the long term. Pretty
concerning.
Heavy stuff.
That's concerning, right? And by the way, we've had President Trump speak here. He's not president at the time. But City Club is not biased, nonpartisan, as I'll tell you again, because we are talking about a Senate race that will be coming up soon.
Yeah.
So it's important to mention that, but that's some concerning stuff.
Just a little.
There's a lot of concerning stuff. I mean, the world's on fire. I mean, really. And let's start, let's go a little bit global. We don't have to stick with just Trump. Like, you see, you're in these briefings. You understand, I think, far better than I and many people in this room what's really happening. What is going on in the world? What's going on? Can we talk about Gaza and Russia and Ukraine, and then maybe a couple other things that are on the horizon?
Sure. Do you have an easier question?
Oh, wait. Yes. How do you fix it all?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So, I mean, there's tremendous turbulence right now around the world. And I see our consuls general from China and Ireland are here. And so they monitor this very closely as well. But I think that fundamentally, if you take, I don't have a unified theory about what's actually happening in each of these places. However, I would respectfully submit that where there's a lack of American leadership, bad things happen. Okay? Bad things happen. If the American government decides that the Middle East is too hard to deal with and they'd rather pivot elsewhere and spend their time, bad things happen in the Middle East. If they decide, in Ukraine, we're just going to let them duke it out and they'll sort it out themselves. Guess what? Bad things happen because Russia is not going to stop at Ukraine's borders. Russia and Putin will go to the next country and then the next. And so that's why I think that it's important for us to have a collaborative relationship with other countries, but one where we are present and where we are engaging. We are not bullies. We are partners. We may be first among equals in a lot of settings, but we don't walk away and we certainly don't make threats. Where we make threats, guess what? People start to hedge. Again, bad things happen. I can get into more detail on that, but I'll just talk about one area of the world where I'm always kind of keeping a close eye. I sometimes worry about Korea and Japan, for instance, where we make threats to them, where we say we're going to walk away, we're not going to provide you with a security umbrella. Guess what? They buy their own umbrella. And that region of the world has seen militarization happen in the past. And we would not want, for instance, what parties in that region are openly discussing today. In Japan, leading political parties in Japan and in Korea are talking about acquiring nuclear weapons. Imagine that. If there was a nuclear weapons arms race on the Korean Peninsula and with Japan, I think it would be calamity. So backing up, that's kind of how I see all these different areas. There has to be American engagement, but in partnership with our allies, friends, and partners.
And you've spent a lot of time on the U.S.-China relationship,
yeah.
Right? Let's talk about China for a minute and where might they land in this global I don't know if we can call it a global repositioning, but it seems like that's happening right now. Where does that stand and how are our relationships with China?
Well, I have to be careful here. I'm going to be... I'll be diplomatic. How's that? CG and I talk all the time. Look, I think that the way I see it is this. I believe that this long-term competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party is very important. It could lead to us being the best version of ourselves as a country and China being the best version of itself. Or it could lead to conflict. And we always want to keep it on the track of us kind of becoming the best version of ourselves and deterring conflict. So what do I mean by best version of ourselves? I'll just give you a couple examples. It's like fixing the legal immigration system that really sucks right now in America. Like, we cannot possibly be the best version of ourselves technologically or economically or competitively if we're pushing away the very best talent from around the world from the United States. It also means investing in our future. It means making sure that people have access to career, technical, and skills-based education, which that's a passion project for me, for the 60% of Americans who don't go to a four-year college to get those skills, whether they're on the south side of Chicago, the west side of Chicago, deep southern Illinois. Everyone, they may not want to go or they may not choose to go to a four-year college, but everyone should have a chance and a ladder into the middle class. The third part of that is investing in technologies of the future, in fundamental research, the type of research that private commercial entities will not do because they don't know where that research will lead. But what we found is that our successful innovation ends up being successful public-private partnerships where the government invests in basic blue sky research. The private sector and universities help to take it from there and end up commercializing it, and we create world-beating technologies. Two legs of that stool, three-legged stool, are being like kicked from underneath right now, universities as well as government. And so if we're going to defund, you know, national labs or the NIH or NSF, guess what? We're not going to have the research to be the best version of ourselves. So those are things that we can control here that we need to get right.
And let's bring it back here since we've solved the world's problems. And you know, just locally, I know you're campaigning. You're on a tour. I think you call it a listening tour.
Listening tour, yeah.
What are you hearing?
What am I hearing? So we've been a lot of places, started out in Quad Cities, and there Congressman Phil Hare endorsed me, so I listened to his endorsement. No, I'm just kidding. So that was good.
Listen to those all day long.
I listened to all these endorsements. But we went from Quad Cities down to Bloomington, down to Mount Vernon, Carbondale, deep southern Illinois, Springfield, Peoria. What I'm hearing is this. I think that there's deep economic anxiety. There's deep economic anxiety. I touch upon what I talked about in my first response, which is I really don't think people feel confident about their economic future. And regardless of where you go, you hear the same things like, I don't know if I can afford a home. I don't know if I can afford health care. I'm not sure if I can afford child care or educating my kids. And certainly, retirement seems like a fantasy, like retiring with dignity and saving for that. In a lot of these places, the manufacturing centers have taken big blows, body blows, okay? In part because of the global competition, in part because of the technological revolution and so forth. And so We have to be the ones that figure out how do we address those economic pain points again in each of these places for them to flourish. I think we can, because a lot of these places have great strengths that have been untapped, whether it's their agricultural economy, whether it's their skilled workforce that may have worked on one type of manufacturing before, but could easily be deployed on another type of manufacturing now. And then finally, our universities. They are first rate. We have, I think it's fair to say, we have one of the country's brightest talent pools in Illinois, and some of the best looking people I've ever seen. But the point is this, which is I think we have a lot of strengths going for us, and we have to tap into those to help improve the economic lot of these people.
How is that? You mentioned this on your tour, agriculture and downstate and in a lot of the different cities and towns. How does that balance? How do you balance that with? Okay, two questions. What are you hearing in Chicago? Because it's a big piece right. of that. And then I'd like to get into that balance of how do you handle how different downstate is from Chicago?
I think what I hear is in Chicago, it's like a tale of two worlds. Okay, there's one part of Chicago that is flourishing. But then you just go 15, 20 minutes south or west, and it's a different world. I forgot what the statistic was, but your life expectancy changes materially just two zip codes over. Okay? That is unacceptable. There's so much underinvestment on the south and west sides of Chicago, just as there's underinvestment in rural Illinois, that I feel that is a no-brainer target for our concerted energies at improving the state of Illinois. Like, I think that we have to think out of the box here about these places. And we have to be willing as Democrats or indeed public servants or Republicans or independents, we have to think out of the box and come up with solutions that might be slightly different. But the most important thing is they have to be effective. We have to build out these, we have to bring economic development to these places. It's not enough to just bring one grant or one stream of government revenue. There has to be a business base that is self-sustaining, that then draws more people, and you start to see amenities come back to these areas. I mean, we have pharmacy deserts, we have food deserts, we have grocery store deserts. You name it, it's hard to find a lot of things that are necessary for people to take care of their families down there.
And in the midst of all this, budgets are incredibly tight.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing city, state, public schools, you name it, huge deficits.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like with the administration, it sounds like that they're not going to come to the rescue there.
Right.
What happens in the next few years when we're not getting an influx, we're out of the COVID money's gone, that's dried up, right? And now who knows what may be cut. What do these next few years look like? And how do we come back from that?
Right. I think that I go back to a couple things respectfully. I think that our talent, our human capital and talent here are second to none. In addition, our logistics are excellent. We have world-beating universities and research centers here. Our healthcare systems are relatively top-notch. We have to go back to our strengths, and we have to figure out how do we utilize those strengths to draw more people to come here to do their work and their business than they would do elsewhere. But of course, that takes making sure that we continue to improve our public safety here. And if I were privileged to become U.S. Senator, I would do everything I could to draw those public safety dollars from Washington to Chicago in partnership with the CPD, which I think is very well run right now, all along with the U.S. Attorney's Office and local law enforcement. By the way, this is a good news story that doesn't get enough attention. There's real partnership going on now in Chicago between the state's attorney, the CPD, the U.S. Attorney's Office in a way that we haven't seen before. And so that is something to build on. So improve the public safety. Try to do whatever we can to bring investment dollars here. Utilize our strengths. Invest in technologies of the future that are going to be based here and where innovation is going to happen, whether it's quantum, artificial intelligence, or advanced manufacturing. And then I think finally what I think we have to do is we have to work on some of those macro issues that I talked about before at the federal level and get on the same page. Legal immigration must be fixed. Legal immigration is the golden goose that lays the golden eggs for our economy. And if you don't fix that, nothing else gets fixed. If you fix it, the sky is, I mean, the horizons are endless. The second thing is you've got to fix the skills-based education system. I and a guy named G.T. Thompson authored the law that modernizes our nation's skills-based and vocational education system. It's called Career Technical Education Now. It was wildly successful. It helps 11 million people get a higher quality skills-based education today than it did before. However, one big problem. It's terribly under-resourced. Terribly under-resourced. And so routinely, every single community college and high school district in the state that is funded through my law or our law is oversubscribed. They don't have enough instructors. They don't have enough machines. They don't have enough facilities, even though young people want to do that work. Again, I come back to our skill set or our strength, which is the human capital. If we don't invest enough in that human capital, then we can't push the envelope of what we can achieve economically, which I understand we're in tough times, but you got to rely on your human capital to get through this.
Great. I certainly agree, and I appreciate hearing all of those great strengths that our diverse economy and city and state has. These hospitals, these are all institutions, hospitals, universities, and others that are regular, at City Club, and we really try to bring all those folks together. Yes. To move things forward. We are in a great position.
That's another thing which I hear repeatedly about Illinois and Chicago, especially. The civic leaders, the business leaders, they are so invested in the success of this region. And so, again, we need to be the cheerleaders. We need to be the cheerleaders for our own success. And many of you are, and we need to continue to do that at the federal level, whether it's a U.S. senator, whether it's a governor, or anybody else. And just, we can wear our jerseys as Republicans, Democrats, whatever, but at the end of the day, when we're collaborating and bringing big things here, I think we can work together in a very productive fashion.
And so we mentioned briefly the Senate race, but let's get into that a little bit. Let's talk a little politics. As I mentioned, we've had Congresswoman Kelly, we've had Lieutenant Governor Stratton here in similar capacities. How is that race going? How are you faring? And maybe if you had 2 minutes to explain to us why you should be senator over anyone else, what would that entail?
Sure. Well, I think it's going well. I think that it's basically a three-person race as of right now. And I think that, look, I have nothing negative to say about either Juliana or Robin. They're friends. They're good people. Okay. I think the two things that differentiate me from them are I talked about those economic anxieties and pain points that people are feeling right now. I've spent my career in Congress and indeed my life kind of working on these issues, whether it's skills-based education or as a former small business person. I like to joke that I sign the front of the check and the back of the check, like many of you, and it's hard. It's hard to meet payroll. It's hard to get investments and hard to succeed. But those are some of the skill sets that we need right now to address some of those economic pain points. The second set of issues has to do with accountability. Okay? I've spent my career in Congress standing up to bad actors and bullies. Whether it's e-cigarette companies going after our youth, trying to hook them on vapes, or food conglomerates trying to poison our baby food with toxic heavy metals, I've gone after all of them. I've gotten accountability and results. Now I need to stand up to the biggest bully of them all, Donald Trump. He's a bully. That's the way he acts. And I think we have to be the ones that don't show fear. That doesn't mean that we have to be offensive. We don't have to be somehow people other than ourselves. But we have to stand up for the values that motivate and animate America and that have propelled this country forward for hundreds of years in a positive direction.
You mentioned a couple things, and I just want to, your previous City Club appearances, you focused solely on, not solely, but mostly on those two issues that you mentioned a minute ago, vaping and the health, you know, the children and also skills and workforce development. I would encourage you all, if you weren't here for those, to go to our website and watch those videos and maybe you can see the progress that has been made in that spirit. I'll mention you could also watch the videos of the other candidates who have been here. And for that matter, Donald Trump
has
also spoken here. Because we're not biased or partisan, but I think that's a great, those were 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, and I think you've made some significant progress on both of those issues since then.
Well, when I first launched the investigation of Juul and the vaping industry and the e-cigarette industry, one quarter of our high school students were vaping, okay? As soon as we announced that investigation, by the way, the reason I got into that is because my own kid, who's now 20, but at the time was a high school freshman, was approached almost 10 times within the first 2 weeks of school to try vaping. And my wife, Priya, who's, you know, kind of the rock of our family, told me all about this, and it just scared the hell out of us. And then I looked into it more with our staff, and it turned out to be a full-blown epidemic. When we did that investigation, Donald Trump then announced he, too, was going to investigate, and then they used our findings from my committee, our investigation, to inform the first regulation of e-cigarettes and marketing of e-cigarettes at the federal level ever undertaken. And so that set of reforms or regulation was the first time it happened. In successive administrations, so after Trump 1, then there was Biden, then Trump 2, we've seen the percentage of people vaping go down in high school. It's still too high, but it's gone down quite a bit. We've seen the regulations improve a little bit. We still have more to do, but that was a big improvement, let me put it that way. On the CTE, I told you about that. We authored the law that has now, I think, become a model for how you should do career technical education. And here's the model, okay? We at the federal government provide the money, but we don't put strings on the money except for one thing. We say whatever you use the money for has to be done in a way where the schools and the local employers collaborate to create the curriculum. Why? Because whatever they're teaching has to be in demand. And that thing has taken off like wildfire. Every single school district in the country is benefiting from it. In my own area, School District 214 is kind of 214, 211, U46 are models for getting hundreds of students into these certification programs so that they end up with a certificate at the end of their high school career so that, God forbid, if they don't finish whatever their next level of schooling is, they still have a way to take care of themselves. And I'll just summarize with a little anecdote that kind of explains this whole issue, if you will. You see, there was this plumber who went to this lawyer's house the other day. And he did the work and he handed the lawyer the bill. And the lawyer took one look at the bill and said, "Oh my God, your hourly charges are higher than mine. And so then the plumber took one look at the bill and one look at the lawyer and said, you're right. It's higher than what I used to charge when I was a lawyer. We have an abundance of excellent lawyers. We have an abundance of excellent lawyers in this country, but we have a shortage of carpenters, electricians, solar panel installers, data engineers, and the list goes on and on. It's about 5 or 6 million job vacancies, even today in this job market. If we can just match the people, whether they're on the south side, the west side, rural Illinois, southern Illinois, all those people with the skills to get these jobs, I have no doubt about the future of our country. It's about as bright and optimistic as you could possibly have because you get people off the bench on the team. That's what we need.
Making real money.
Making real money. We have people in these skills-based education, skills-based professions who are easily making six figures within a very short period of time. Why? Because their skills are in demand. And that's where we need to go. We need to make sure at the end of someone's post-secondary education, they get access to the greatest social welfare program devised by human beings, and that's a J-O-B. If you don't have access to a job, then your education was not very good, in my humble opinion.
And we're going to talk more about that at City Club. You know, Clayco is here, and Bob Clark has been a leader on that for many years. And we've also done with the, you know, talked with Juan Salgado from the City Colleges. There are a lot of things, a lot of factors that play into that, and a lot of great jobs and a lot of great movement in the economy. Yes. In that direction. So we're committed here to keeping that conversation going. Thanks for getting into that. It's already, okay, it's 105. So Caleb, if you're around, will you come on up and grab the microphone? So I do want to ask if there are any other questions. I have a few more, but we only have 10 minutes. Tariffs. Could you? I know you touched on tariffs.
Yeah.
What's happening there? Are they coming? Are they going? Are they happening? Is it really affecting things? Should we plan for more? Talk about tariffs for a minute, please.
What can I say? It's terrifying. I'm just kidding. Okay, I pushed my luck once too many times. Okay, so look, I think this is.
Was that a dad joke? You have kids, right?
Three. Yeah. It's 2016 and 9. So, look, I think that this is the issue, guys, which is that where you have an unlevel playing field, where another country is using economic aggression to actively harm your industry, I think strategic tariffing makes sense. However, blanket tariffs on everything don't make sense, certainly not against your friends and partners and allies, because it pushes them away and makes it more expensive for everybody, whether they're a business or a family, to survive. So that's my overall take, or quick take. With regard to Trump himself, it's just chaos, okay? It's chaos. Nobody knows what's going to happen. It feels like tariff policy runs out of the Oval Office, okay? Whatever he feels that day, whether it's he feels a irritation or annoyance at Brazil or some other country, they get a higher tariff that day. And so I think the net result is that businesses are left unable to plan. And when they can't plan, they can't invest. When they can't invest, they can't hire. And the list, I mean, it's just a cascading set of circumstances. And can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
That issue of tariffs is just an illustration. Like, again, strategic tariffing makes sense. And that's something that we should continue to do. However, where you just usurp emergency powers to hike tariffs to 145% on a country, not only does it not make sense, I believe it's illegal. And so that's a set of reforms we're going to have to make, you know, later on in the next Congress.
Okay. Caleb's over here. Do we have any questions on the floor? I have a couple pre-submitted that I'm going to ask in a moment. But if anyone has a question, raise your hand. No, thank you. We'll come back.
Hi.
Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Taronda Hudson. I am from Chicago Rehab Network. We advocate for affordable housing across the state of Illinois. And my question to you is, given the persistent shortage of affordable housing units in our community and the rising cost of construction, what specific policies or incentives do you propose to incentivize the development of more affordable housing, especially for low and moderate income families?
Thanks. Should I take that?
Housing's
a okay. First,
speaker.
Lower the tariffs on aluminum and steel from Canada. That would be a nice start. I know. Any builder in this room is going to know that the price of housing's gone up quite a bit just because of that issue alone. But, of course, this has been a long-term problem, affordable housing. And I think that the low-income housing tax credit has now been enhanced thanks to recent legislation. But it's not enough. And I think we need to do at least a couple other things, in my humble opinion. One is we absolutely have to be – we have to think out of box about our zoning. Our zoning for multifamily is just ridiculous, and I'm not just pointing fingers at one municipality or another. I think it's all around the country. I think it's all around the state of Illinois. We got to get our head around this, and as Democrats, we need to kind of come to terms that we say one thing and then we practice another when it comes to zoning. The second thing that we have to do is I believe that we have to be radical in revitalizing commercial properties to convert them into residential spaces. But that requires some government assistance. So I've been a prime sponsor of tax credits for that particular purpose. I'll just give you an example. My mall, the Woodfield Mall, who's been to the Woodfield Mall? Everyone. It's one of the most popular in the Midwest. Please come back. I think that two of the anchors of that mall are gone. Sears and Lord and Taylor, there's huge spaces. I could easily see a situation where you convert that into some housing, okay? The reason why these strip malls throughout the suburbs and in the city of Chicago are just vacant and don't have tenants has to do with a lot of factors, but let's take that lemon and make it into lemonade. So push my bill for tax credits to convert commercial space into residential housing.
Thank you for that. I want to mention Mayor Rory Hoskins is here also from Forest Park. I know he's been doing some work on housing too. Thank you for joining us today. Caleb, another question here, and we're gonna make
yeah,
this
hi.
Quick as possible.
My name is Barbara Hausman. I'm an old progressive. I always believed there were safeguards to our democracy. I'm scared. How did we get here as a country so fast? And you said we need to speak up for our values. How do we, as citizens, do that?
I think the reason we got here so fast is because fundamentally, we entrusted the presidency and the executive branch with certain discretionary powers, which we never anticipated would be used other than in the best interests of the citizens of the United States. Usually, these powers are entrusted as emergency powers. Emergency powers. What we didn't anticipate is a president that would use emergency powers to hike tariffs to 145% or deploy American troops on American soil against American citizens, as he did in Los Angeles, in an effort to crack down in a way that people feel very uncomfortable about. Nor did we see him using emergency powers to claim in self-defense that we were bombing another country. Okay? On the offensive. And so what we're going to have to do in this presidency is continue to do what I've been doing, which is shine a light on the harm to educate people about what exactly is happening, play an inside-outside game in Congress, which is conduct vigilant oversight as much as possible while pursuing litigation on the outside and participating, supporting that. Third, holding people accountable who actually support this, whether they're Republicans or otherwise. And then I think fourth, and very importantly, we have to think about a post-Trump, post-Watergate type of set of reforms that take powers away from the presidency and restore them where they belong. Whether it's with regard to the pardon power, whether it's with regard to, you know, making sure that our data remains private in the digital age so that it doesn't get doged, whether it means stopping the grift that's happening from the White House because their financial interests are so opaque and lack transparency. That whole range of issues need to be tackled. And so that's what I think has to be done. There's stuff that we have to do right now, and then stuff we have to do to prevent another Trump-like presidency from taking root ever again. We can't go through this again.
So, I know there are other questions, and I just want to respect everybody's time, so I will ask maybe if you could come back. Would you come back?
Easier questions? Okay.
We would love to have you back. There's so many issues, like I said, that you tackled here, so many that we haven't even gotten to. Maybe we could close with anything that City Club and this group you mentioned. We have all these different civic leaders here doing different things to make the city and the state better. What else can we be doing here? And what else can we be talking about to make sure that we keep this fight going to better our city and our state?
I think a couple things. One, shine a light on what's working. Let's tell some good news stories about what is working in the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. Because there's a lot, okay? You know it. You see it in your own personal lives and your communities. We need to shine a light on it. And then secondly, And reward those leaders who are helping in that effort as well, right? Because everyone operates under incentives. And it's good to give incentives for that kind of positive activity. The second part is we've got to come together on some of our biggest problems, okay? When we're fighting each other, we can't fight those problems. We can't fight the lack of economic development together if we're fighting each other over petty issues. And so, to me, as a barometer of whether or not we as a state are progressing, it should be tied to the health of the most underdeveloped places in Illinois. We should be looking like a laser at what's happening on the west side, the south side of Chicago, rural Illinois, and southern Illinois, and we should be figuring out how do we lift them up. And I don't care if you also spend time lifting up your own community. I assume you are. But do something extra. What can we do extra to help these other places? Because I guarantee you, if they are lifted up, all of us will benefit. And so that's something that's a challenge, but an opportunity for all of us.
You heard it here. Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
You're always welcome.
Thank you.
You all are welcome back. We have all sorts of great programs coming up, and so we hope you'll join us just in next week. We have Chicago's Fiscal Framework on August 12th. We have Shedd Aquarium on August 20th. Congressman Mike Quigley, one of your colleagues, on August 28th. And then in September, Uniting for a Cure, Chicago's bold new model to transform breast cancer research. A really interesting program from a number of hospitals, some that you mentioned today. There's a lot to come, a lot more than that. Please keep coming. Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, thanks so much. All the best in your race. Thanks for being at City Club.
Thank you so much.